Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain and once more I'm joined by Peter Hart.
Hello.
And today, Pete, we're going to continue with the fifth in our series on the Fife and Forth for Yeomanry, which is a series that accompanies the publication of your new book.
Coincidentally, yes.
Burning Steel, A Tank Regiment at War. And that was out on the 12th of May, dear listeners.
Well, hopefully most of our listeners will have already rushed to buy one.
Well, if not, they've still got time.
They have. Although, surely it'll be almost sold out by
almost,
now.
Yeah. Almost.
Yeah.
So, where
Look,
did we...
flying pig, Gary.
So, where did we leave our heroes, Pete?
Well, we left them. We were doing, last time, Operation Epsom, and we're doing today, Hill 112, which is a bit of a coda. It's part of Operation Epsom, but we're sort of dealing with it separately because it's easy to identify. The second Fife and Forth Yeomanry had a dispiriting day, really. We mentioned that on the 27th of June. The only good bit of news, in a sense, was that the 2nd Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders had done brilliantly. A sort of independent infantry action. They'd captured the bridge over the Odon at Turmavale and carved out a whole 200-yard diameter bridgehead, which had been reinforced by the motorised 8th Rifle Brigade. They're real heroes in this whole action we're talking about, followed up by the 23rd Hussars and then the motorised infantry of the 159th Brigade. That's the motorised infantry brigade of the 11th Armour Division, which the 54 fires were in. And they'd expanded the whole bridgehead to take up defensive positions around, we'll put a map up, Baron Sur Odon and Turmavale itself. Now, on 28th of June, that's the day after the Lord Mayor's show, the 28th of June, the whole of the 11th Armoured Division, the rest of the armoured division, would cross the Odon and drive on across the high ground, which is dominated by Hill 112, towards the Orne River. The Orne gives you the Orne.
Hmm. Sorry, I wasn't listening. Can you repeat that?
Yes, certainly, Gary. Privately.
Now, the battle was in the balance, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Wasn't
because
it?
Although the 15th Scottish Division and the 11th Armoured Division had made some progress, German reinforcements were beginning to arrive.
But those German reinforcements have got a big problem. Why aren't the German reinforcements... Why don't they bring success? What's the problem they're facing? Because the thing about war is that there's problems on both sides. So what problems are the German high command facing?
Well, the pressures that were imposed on them were such that instead of concentrating their forces for a decisive counterattack, infantry and tank units were hurled into battle as soon as possible. They were attacking unsupported and hence open to serious losses.
So German success in the past, the Blitzkrieg warfare method, what had that been based on?
Well, it had all been founded on their tanks, motorised infantry, air power and artillery being all meshed together to achieve their objectives. Air power had already been wrested from them, but now the other elements were beginning to have to fight separate battles due to the Allied pressure.
Just the strength of the Allied pressure, yeah. Now, so they had to do something And on the 28th of June, the Germans counterattack. So what do? They push forward on either side of what has become known as the Scottish Corridor. That's around the road leading from Shire towards Tourmaville. And basically, that's because that the 15th Scottish Division had taken it. On the eastern side, they strike along the Carnvillers-Bocage Road through the village of Mourn, and that's crashing into the left flank of the Scottish Corridor. What happens with that attack?
Well, they achieved some initial success, but they were pounded mercilessly by the mass guns of the Royal Artillery, and the attack was in fact thwarted.
And this is a theme we're going to develop. Well, we did the artillery, the Fife and Forfar Yeomanry. The South Notts Hussars.
It's funny you've got a book about them.
I have, yeah. Forgotten that one. I have no idea what that's called. Close to the Edges, when I use it.
At close range.
That's it. But we've done that. But one of the things is that artillery power is super important to the Allies and to the British in particular, because it's always there. It's not like air power that which sort of you fly over, drop your bombs, and go away. Artillery's always there, isn't it? Pounding away. Now, there's another attack, though. What's that? What other attack do the Germans launch? I think I can guess where that is.
Well, that's on the right flank of the salient, driving in on Granville-sur-Odon, which had been finally captured by the 9th Cameronians, otherwise known as Scottish Rifles, at just after 12 o'clock. They had scant chance to consolidate their position before the German attack hit them hard. The fighting that would rage all day.
Now, do you think this is uppermost in the minds of the lads from the 2nd Fife and 4th Yeomanry?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so. After the recent hard fighting, they were focused on getting as much sleep as possible, eating their rations and attending to other necessities of life.
What's that a euphemism for? Well, going to the loo, sorting themselves out, yeah.
Those necessities of life.
No, not sex and drugs and rock and roll. Oh, dear. So, on the morning of the 28th of June, the 2nd Fife and 4th Yeomanry are ordered forward. No, they don't go to Mourn or Granville. That's the left or right flank. They're going further. They go across the Odon into the very, very tip of the Scottish... Corridor salient. They would use the Tourmaville Bridge and push across the high ground, and they were meant to secure the Orne River bridges. That never happened, but it's the objective.
Now, this bold undertaking, that reflected Pip Roberts' optimism.
Is that Lieutenant General Pip Roberts?
Yeah, I know him as Pip.
Oh, hang on, or is it Major? Oh, yeah, it's Lieutenant. Oh, no, it's Major General. Oh, God. I'm having a bad day at the office.
Whatever his rank, he was very optimistic.
He was.
That they had now
optimistic Pip, they used to call him.
That they'd now broken through the German defence lines, and that the way ahead would now be relatively clear.
So ahead of the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry, the 23rd Hussars, they're ordered to move up onto Hill 112 itself. Now, well, tell me a bit about Hill 112, because we've both been there Normandy visits.
It's described as a whaleback hill. It's barely noticeable in itself.
We've been up on it. It isn't a sort of massive hill,
no,
is it?
No, it's a gentle incline, isn't it? Yeah. But it was a fluke of geography which offered excellent views over much of the contested battlefield.
So which way can you see from there? I remember looking at a couple of things up there. What's the most obvious thing when you're up there?
Well, looking towards Carn itself, across the Carpiquet airfield and over to the Orne River.
So you've got a good view. It's an important tactical
It's high ground.
High ground, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the 23rd Hussars, they're additional to them up there on the Hill 112 is the 8th Rifle Brigade. And they take up defensive positions in an orchard that's on the summit. And we went up, right? It's very interesting up there, it is. Now, who else might be getting involved up there, though?
Yeah, it's rather unfortunate that the Germans are also beginning to climb the hill, pushing up from Esquire on the southern slopes. Esquire. Esquire.
Very good. Yeah, they're also coming. And a squadron of the 2nd Fife and 4th Yeomanry come into contact with the panzers. What do they identify them as, Gary?
Well, as always, they're tigers.
Yeah, everything's a tiger.
Everything's a tiger.
And you're going to tell us what Captain Douglas Hutchison, Pinky Hutchison. I don't know why I like that nickname.
Why was he called Pinky?
Because his complexion. He was quite a chubby lad. Yes. How did you get to do this one? Anyway, he was Headquarter Troop A Squadron. A great lad.
The whole brigade went across and spread out on the slopes of Hill 112, the summit of which remained in dispute. The Germans were very reluctant to yield the summit. We were astride a road going over one side of it. There was a ridge in front, and I got hull down. I remember seeing, quite a long way ahead, I wasn't sure whether it was a self-propelled gun or a Tiger, dug in on the far side. I bracketed the thing, and I hit it. It seemed to go up in smoke. It was at long range. What you could do with a deliberate shoot like that was you corrected the line after your first shot, pretty accurately, and then you simply bracketed, and generally within three rounds you would be on the target. It was quite a handy weapon with HE. You could use it in two ways, either explosion on hitting, or you could do an air burst. When there was a delayed action, the shell came down and hit the ground in front, bounced up, and then burst.
Now, so during this fighting, the 23rd Hussars, they're pulled back to replenish their ammunition, and the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment moves up onto Hill 112, while the 2nd Fife and 4th Yeomanry shuffle around to take their place to the left. Now, as they move round to the left, if you see what I mean, they come within easy range of the German artillery that's based round about the Carpiquet airfield. Now, up on that summit, it as you remember, Gary, it's pretty wide open. There are some trees, but it's wide open up there, isn't it? And what does that mean if there's artillery? And what's the problem?
Well, it becomes apparent that the tanks can't survive. They were excruciatingly visible.
Especially the Shermans. They're so high, aren't they?
And hence vulnerable to fire from 88mm and other anti-tank guns that the Germans had deployed well back on the reverse slopes.
Yeah, but the same problems, of course, are facing the German tanks. They're also super visible. They're also unable to get a grip. And I'm going to tell you what, Oberscharführer.
Yeah, can I just say, I'd never heard of Oberscharführer before.
I've no idea what it means.
So I had a look, and it means senior squad leader. It was a Nazi paramilitary rank that existed between 1932 and 1945, which was first used by the brown shirts, the Sturmabteilung.
Ooh.
But, yeah, it's a very unusual. I'd never heard of it. And you're going to tell us what Oberscharführer Willy Kretschmar of the 12th SS Panzer Regiment says.
When we'd approached within 300 to 400 metres, we spotted retreating English soldiers between the trees. We fired the turret and forward machine guns into the wooded terrain. At approximately 100 metres from the wood, we changed from the wedge into a staggered line. That means a wedge-shaped formation of the tanks into a staggered line, since the opening in the forest was only 80 to 100 metres wide. The incline on our left was covered with bushes and trees. I was now driving as the Point Panzer. Our direction was approximately northwest. The gun was pointing at 12 o'clock. An anti-tank shell was ready in the barrel. We cautiously made our way forward along the small forest, which was 150 to 200 metres wide. At the end of the forest, I ordered an observation stop. I searched the terrain to the right in front of us with my binoculars for tanks and PAK. That's a PAK, that's the anti-tank guns. Since I did not spot anything suspicious, I ordered, Panzer, march!
Ooh.
After a drive of only 10 to 15 metres, there was a sudden bang. Sparks were flying, and we noticed a hit from the right, 3 o'clock direction. I shouted at the director, Sturman Schneider, backward march! He reacted at lightning speed, threw the Panzer into reverse and backed into the cover of the forest at full throttle. Not 1 second too soon, otherwise the British would have nailed us directly. Immediately in front of our bow, anti-tank shells ripped ugly black furrows into the green grass. Now the forest came back to life. Fire from rifles and machine guns was pinging against the armour. We were covered by mortar artillery fire. We did not hold back either and briskly returned the fire as we were backing away. We returned to our assembly area without any losses. There we inspected our damages. A clean hit. Gone through between the engine and fighting compartments, approximately 25 centimetres below the turret. Except for a small shrapnel stuck in my right thigh, we all escaped with just a scare. So basically, they got up there, tried to get onto the summit, and met with a barrage of fire, were hit, although not damn badly, and go away. I think I might have moaned more about a small shrapnel piece stuck in my right thigh than he did, but there you go.
Now, throughout all of this, the men of the 8th Rifle Brigade, they endured in their trenches in the orchard, although they suffered terrible casualties.
And they hold on there all night. They don't go back. But at night, the 2nd, 5th and 4th Yeomanry, they lager on the backward slopes of Hill 112. And they disperse to the camps broken up just before dawn, and they return back up to their forward positions. On 29th of June, the Germans strike back hard again. By this time, who's arrived, Gary?
It's the 2nd Panzer Corps, that's the 9th and 10th SS Panzer Divisions. And after a long and increasing laborious journey from the Eastern Front, harassed throughout by Allied air power and the consequent damage to the transport infrastructure.
Yeah, there's bridges being damaged, everything. This is what air power gives you, isn't it?
But now, once more, these precious reinforcements, which were irreplaceable military assets, they're going to be flung into action with scant chance to rest, reorganise, recce or coordinate with the intended supporting arms.
Now, they planned two major thrusts. And when I say planned, hastily is probably the word you need just in front of that. So what are these plans? Well, the first of them is the 9th SS Panzer Division would attack the western flank of the Scottish corridor, driving towards Sher. Now, that's not all. What's the second thrust?
Well, the 10th SS Panzer Division, they would hit the 11th Armoured Division clustered around Hill 112.
Now, did the British have any idea what was coming?
Well, they had some inkling of this from the ultra intelligence, but the tight security restricted that knowledge to the higher echelons of command, down only as far as General Miles Dempsey of the 2nd Army.
Yeah, this is the thing about ultra. If you show your hand, if you show that you know what they're doing, then they'll realise the codes are being broken. We did a podcast on Tommy Flowers, who was key towards with Colossus in breaking those codes. But this is the problem. So who does Dempsey tell, and does he really tell him what's going on?
No, he does warn Lieutenant General Richard O'Connor of the 8th Corps that German forces are building up. He could not, or perhaps did not, press home the true nature of the threat, and it was only late on the 28th of June that he issued a direct order to withdraw from the Odon Bridgehead.
Now, sadly, or perhaps, whatever, for whatever reason, Richard O'Connor doesn't immediately respond, does he? He's still perhaps hoping to secure a significant breakthrough, and he is not made aware of why Dempsey's ordering this, is he? Because the cost of the security. What does he do? Does he pass on the orders?
No, he fails to pass on Dempsey's orders to his divisional commanders.
So Pip Roberts, commanding the Major General, commanding 11th Armoured Division, isn't told, is he?
No, and instead of this, O'Connor simply moved up more of the 43rd Wessex Division to take over the defence of the eastern flank of the Scottish Corridor, while the 15th Scottish Division guarded the western flank. Pip Roberts was told to temporarily suspend the advance on the Orne River and, for the moment, hold his ground.
But that's not what they'd been ordered to do by Dempsey. This is interesting, yeah. Now, what happens when the German counterattacks crunch home? The 44th Royal Tank Regiment is heavily engaged fighting off the attacks of the 10th SS Panzer Division. Now, where's that? That's on Hill 113. Numbering's fantastic.
Imaginatively named.
Yeah. I think just to the east of Hill 112. These are not big hills, are they? How much higher than 112 do you think it is?
One.
Metre I'm going for, but it could be a foot. We've had this problem before. Why did I ever... It exposes our ignorance, doesn't it? But it's not much higher. What else do they do as part of this attack?
Well, they also hit the Germans, also hit the 2nd Argylls defending the Gavras Bridge crossing and the surrounding wooded area.
So that's the 10th Panzer Division. What are the 9th Panzer Division? Who they smash into?
Well, they smashed into the 7th Seaforth Highlanders in Valtrou and the 9th Cameronians in Granville-sur-Odon.
Now, these attacks are, broadly speaking, they're held back. They're withstood. Who do you think's crucial to this?
Well, it's in part thanks to the massed batteries of the Royal Artillery, whose concentrated fire helped break up the German assaults and chewed up newly arrived units before they even got into battle.
So before they can sort of get to the actually fighting at the front, they're being chewed up on their way in.
Yeah, the RAF also played a useful role as the weather improved.
Of course, yeah, because they can see what's going on and they can bomb the buggers, so to speak.
Bomb the buggers.
It's a technical term, the RAF use it. I, of course, wouldn't use that.
Now, these flanking attacks well might have doomed the 2nd, 5th and 4th Fire Yeomanry, isolated as they were, 5 miles deep into German territory in the bridgehead over the Odon. But its eyes were concentrated for the most part on Hill 112.
So they're not really aware or interested. Well, they might be interested, but they don't really know what's going on behind them. They're just interested on the fight for Hill 112. The battle's fluctuating. This is about the 2nd, 4th of Yeomanry, but let's pay due tribute to someone else. Who is it who really, really holds that summit?
Well, it's the 8th Rifle Brigade, who we mentioned earlier. They held on to the positions with a grim determination. Now, at this point, we'll take a short break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome back, listeners.
Where were we? Well, we're in another day. Another day has come upon us. And in the morning, the Sea Squadron begin to climb up the hill. Now, they've got A Squadron on their left, while B Squadron is back at the village of Baron. Now, this is quite exciting for me, really, because I'm going to be Charlie Workman again. Lieutenant Charles whatever. First Troop, C Squadron. He was a great veteran to interview. I still remember being in his house. What a wonderful man he was. And that morning, this is the morning of the 29th. As the German counterattacks come, and as he approaches to go back up the hill 112, he gets a bit of a warning, doesn't he? A bit of an inkling that things are going to get a bit tougher as this bloody great German armored division start to attack. And he says this: "I met a bunch of infantrymen running down like mad, headed by a major. I said to him, 'What's going on?' seems to become northern, never mind. Oh, he said, it's hell up there. And he dashed away past me and disappeared. Hill 112 wasn't a massive hill, but it was big enough so that when we were on top, we could see what was going on the other side. When I got up on top of Hill 112, down there was a road full of Germans. Right, let's have a crack. We were banging away at them. There was no tanks, but we brewed up one or two lorries about half a mile from us. Not all that far from us. There was a lot of mortar fire and Nebelwerfers fired from a lorry. No tactical skill could avoid that if a mortar shell came down. You didn't know where the mortar was. You knew roughly where they were coming from. You could hear a shell coming, but with a mortar you had no indication at all. Just woof! And usually someone would buy it. We saw one or two Nebelwerfers down on that road. We fired at them and they shoved off. It was a rocket that made an awful scream and then bang, bang, bang. It's a multi-barreled rocket launcher, basically, or mortar fire thing. Yeah.
We have explained how there was a large contingent of English that had joined the fire from the
Charlie Workman, I think, was from Glasgow. I do apologise for wavering in accents there.
Now, Robert Nurse was the gunner in the crew of Lieutenant Eric Lamont on the slopes of Hill 112 when they thought they had an opportunity to knock out one of the German tanks. And this is what Trooper Robert Nurse of 2 Troop has to say. We were overlooking Carpiquet Aerodrome on a forward slope. There was a big wood across the other side of the valley, and suddenly four, I think they might have been tigers, started crossing our bows from right to left. Lamont directed me on the leading one with a 75mm, and I fired. I watched the trace, and it hit the bloody thing. The turret, it went boom and bounced off. We saw these four barrels coming round. Driver, reverse! And we went back over the hill. They fired at us, but all four missed. We were back on the other side of the hill before you could say knife.
Now, that's sort of the reverse of the story the German told. Almost identical, isn't it? What sort of bigger truth is hidden in that whole story told by Robert Nurse?
Well, it tells the dispiriting truth about the 75mm armament of the Sherman. Even a direct hit with an armour-piercing shell would achieve nothing against the armour of the latest German tanks, even from the side.
So what's their best chance to disable them, to take out one of the more modern panzers?
Well, you've got to disable their tracks or hit them from the rear. It could take three or four Shermans operating together to take out a panther.
You mean take out?
Or even out. While many considered that the Tiger was best dealt with by the Typhoons of the RAF. And in contrast to that, the Sherman Firefly was proving more effective.
That was more effective, yeah. And there's a story in the regimental history that I've always liked, which this is the regiment by Sellers. You can look it up. It's an old-fashioned regimental history, but it is a good one. And they proudly boast that Sergeant William Hurd knocked out a Tiger in his Firefly. Now, this is the beauty of oral history, because it's not quite the same as the official record sometimes. Now, his gunner was a chap called John Scott, but he also had a driver. And his driver was amusingly to me called Trooper Harold Wilson, and a 4 Troop deceased gunner. And he gives a sort of rather more sort of down-to-earth version. I can't do it, a Harold Wilson accent, sadly. And he was Scottish, so I'm not going to do it.
Harold Wilson was Scottish.
Yes, it's a little known fact. We shot up a tank with a 17-pounder. We were anything from 1,000 to 1,200 yards from this tank. It certainly wasn't a Tiger or anything like that. It would have been one of the Mark IVs, which is not quite what it says in the...
It probably was one of the Mark IVs. That's the first time that anybody's actually said it wasn't a Tiger.
Another story about a Firefly armed with this more powerful 17-pounder is Terry Boyne's temporarily acting as a gunner. We have a lot of quotes from Terry, and he also claimed a success firing at a Mark IV, probably somewhat lower down the hill. I was unable to accurately locate this, and this is one thing to remember. Sometimes they didn't know where they were, and they don't know what time it is a day, and you have to just look for the balance of probability. Anyway, this is, you're going to say what Trooper Terry Boyne, 4 Troop A Squadron, says.
We had a report on our radio from one of the dug-in tanks on our left that something was moving behind a hedge, and it was moving in our direction. This had happened frequently. You'd fire at something you thought was there, and if you'd check, you'd find it was a cow. No doubt a lot of cows used to get killed like that. So we fired a couple of HE, high explosive, to punch a little hole in the hedge. We were scanning this area. I held the gun near enough where I thought it might be if it was moving. It was only a guesstimate. With the gun sitting as it was, through the hedge came the nose of a tank. Edge on, oblique, with the tank climbing up to get over the bank. It just popped up in my sights. We're only talking about 80 yards, not far. I didn't have to do anything other than hit the button. I banged the shot off, which was armour piercing. It hit it right behind the sprocket. It was a Mark IV. It had small cupola on the top and it was actually moving. The commander must have been moving it around as I fired. He must have looked straight down the barrel of the Firefly. That must have been his vision. A load of dust went up from around it from the impact of it. It rolled back and we punched another shot right in.
That'd be the last thing that that poor German commander ever saw. This is the thing about this fighting. Do you not get the sort of tenseness of it? Because if you make a mistake, go through a hedge and there's someone waiting for you on the other side that you can't see. And it's sort of almost like creeping around and you don't know what's happening. And the tense, there must have been a lot of nervous breakdowns or a lot of PTSD triggered by the sheer tension of it all.
Oh. Now, as the long day wore on, A Squadron relieved C Squadron up on the top of Hill 112. As night fell, they remained in situ rather than falling back to the lager.
Now, that's because they have to stay to support the 8th Rifle Brigade, don't they? Because it's getting a bit tense up there. So, once again, you're going to say what Trooper Terry Boyne, and this is another stress-filled story for Troop A Squadron.
It came on the air that they couldn't get the supplies through because the Germans had cut the bridge again on the path back. So we were left up there. At night, the weird thing was the fact that the Germans were down the slope and you could hear them refuelling their vehicles, throwing cans about, hear them actually talking. I suppose the wind was in the right direction. The bit that really got you worried was when you heard the engines start and the old tracks start rolling. You're not sure whether it's coming up, going down or whatever. And then after a minute or so, they'd stop and switch off. It's a war of nerves.
Now, can you imagine that, Gary?
No, frankly.
Now, little did Terry Boyne, there he is in his tank with his crew, the rest of the crew. It's a four-man crew because it's a Firefly. Well, if it's a game of poker, then the British High Command are just about to fold, aren't they? So what happens? That's the night of 29th of June, 29th of June going into 30th of June. What's the situation? It's delicately balanced, isn't it?
The 8th Rifle Brigade, they're still clinging on to the top of Hill 112. The 29th Armour Brigade was supporting them, and so far was withstanding the Panzer
attacks. Now, what about the Scottish Corridor further back? Is that holding?
Well, that's now defended by both the 15th and 43rd Divisions, and they are just about holding on despite serious pressure.
So they're just about holding. They're holding the Scottish Corridor. They're holding the Hill 112. But then on at 2200 hours on 29th of June, there's a real bombshell, isn't there? Major General Pip Roberts is ordered to pull back the 29th Armoured Brigade with immediate effect. Now, this is a bit of a surprise. Do you think this is controversial? Funny enough, it is controversial, but I'm not sure it should be. What do you think?
Well, from one perspective, it seemed that the bridgehead over the Odon and Hill 112, which had been paid for with blood and guts, was now to be given up without a fight. But the corridor was precariously thin, only 2,500 yards at best.
2,500 yards? Just wide?
Yeah.
So that's just over a mile.
And it would take only a small penetration by the German counterattacks to pinch it out, leaving the units in the Odon bridgehead high and dry.
Well, this is the thing, that the ground might have cost a lot of blood and guts, as you said, but what if something went wrong?
Well, a lot more could have been lost if anything went wrong. Attracting the attention of the German panzer divisions was surely only a valid policy if the attacks were held without calamitous setbacks.
So, the 29th Armoured Brigade is in a very, very vulnerable position. What if it had been cut off? What if they'd been.
Yeah, I mean, on balance, General Miles Dempsey probably took the sensible decision, and certainly Pinky Hutchison agrees. And this is what Captain Douglas Hutchison of HQ Truck A Squadron has to say. They were nervous about the corridor being behind us being cut, and to have a whole brigade of tanks marooned, he means, over on the far side of the Odon. They had a lot of 88mm anti-aircraft guns on Carpike Aerodrome. It could have developed in quite a nasty way if the corridor was cut. That's what the Germans tried very hard to do. They weren't successful, happily, and we were withdrawn during the night over a captured bridge.
Now, they picked their time, didn't they? They did it carefully, and under the cover of that night, they were able to retire. In good order, they went back across the Odon, and they went all the way back to Noiry-en-Bessin, which they got to at first light on the 30th of June. Now, by this time, they're all completely and utterly exhausted. They're just, well, what's the technical term we often use for this?
Buggered. Now, Charlie Workman, he remembered the awful state that he was in. These are young, fit men, but sleep deprivation and prolonged combat had driven them to the very edge. And this is what Lieutenant Charlie Workman of One Troop C Squadron says.
We never put hatches over. We always kept our head and... He means the command, tank commanders. We always kept our head and shoulders out. Map around my neck and use your binoculars. In fact, at first, we wore our cheese-cutter hat, our ordinary cap, until we began to realise, with the heavy mortaring and the Nebelwerfers, we'd better wear these steel helmets. One was on a constant lookout. We had a rough time of it. These guys weren't that far away, so we never left the tank at all. We stayed put. I was in the tank for 5 days. Everyone else in the tank is seated. The driver, his co-driver, the wireless operator, your gunner. The tank commander's got a small seat he pulls down. It's a sort of spring-loaded thing. Just a little thing. In the nature of things, you don't really sit on a seat when you're in action. You're standing. I was in the tank for 5 days. I couldn't get out. I had to be pulled out, and my ankles had swollen right up. Wow. What about Pinky Hutchinson? How's he doing?
Well, he's also at the end of his tether. Extreme fatigue, it takes many forms. And this is what Captain Douglas Hutchison of HQ Troop A Squadron says. I was so damn tired that I was beginning to see things, and my illusion was that everything I saw was a dead cow. There were a lot of dead cows about the place. In that sort of weather, their corpses were swelling up, the legs sticking up. Anything I saw moving turned into a dead cow. This was pure fatigue. I'd had very little sleep for 4 days.
Now, so they're back, and this next story is a terrible story that I'm going to tell. Jack Rex was one of the lads. He's a trooper in HQ squadron, and he was going to the latrine, Gary. That's what he was doing. He was going to find a little bit of privacy for a latrine break with his shovel, and he found an unpleasant memento of the past fighting. And this next tale is not nice, is it? He says this: I went out to this orchard into a cornfield. As I went, there was a big corn ring. I thought, well, that's funny. Being a farmer's son, I'd seen these rings in grass fields, which are caused by a fungi that grows in a circle. But I'd never seen it in a cornfield, and it was a perfect circle. The corn was trampled down about a yard wide. When I finished, I walked over, and I was more surprised to see the inside of the circle sprayed pink. I thought, that's funny. So I walked round, and when I got to the other side, there was a young German laid dead. He had his hands round his neck. Something had hit his jugular vein, a little bit of shrapnel or a bullet, and he tried to put a tourniquet on, and all he had was a German newspaper. He'd run round in circles half a dozen times. The paper had got soaked, then it had broke, but he was still holding it when I found him. The seams of his trousers had split with his body swelling up. Because I found him, they made me in charge of the burial party. We buried him more or less where he was laid. I've often thought about it. Nobody put anything on his grave to say who he was. Never took his discs off. Just buried him like a dog. He had a photo of himself standing with what looked like his sister, dad and mother outside of a log cabin in amongst the pine trees. You could see mountains in the background. Even though he was the enemy, I still think about him. He was only a bit of a lad. Well, it's a horrible quote, isn't it? And it's just his family. They'd never know what happened to him, would it? They'd never have a grave to visit or anything. I mean, it's not the end of the world, I suppose. They being dead is the main thing. He's a loss to his family. But it is quite sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, the withdrawal of 29th Armour Brigade, that marked the end of the attempt made during Operation Epsom to advance to the Orne River.
So what's the focus now?
Well, the focus shifts to defending what they had, sucking in and destroying as much German armour as possible. In this, the role of the massed medium and heavy batteries of the Royal Artillery continued to be vital. Rapidly deployed and superbly concentrated barrages of shells broke up German counterattacks, inflicting serious casualties.
And not to forget, I know I'm a bit, I do like the artillery. I'm very keen on the role of artillery in Normandy, but the RAF also is playing a big role as the weather gets, day by day gets better. What are they up to?
Well, they're able to arrest any concentration of German fighting strength. And sometimes this is to devastating effect.
And all this erodes away these German reserves that have been thrown into the battle. And the German attacks on 29th of June to the 1st of July, that's their most focused effort. And after which the fighting starts to ebb away, doesn't it? How do we sum up Operation Epsom? Because Hill 112 is part of Operation Epsom.
Yeah, I mean, in all, the British had lost around 150 tanks knocked out or badly damaged. Losses that were more than compensated for by new units arriving and tank crew replacements. The Germans, they've been estimated as losing around 120 tanks, which they could not easily replace.
Yeah, and Montgomery, always a man to look on the bright side of anything that he's involved with, would later claim that he never intended a breakthrough. Merely, he just desired to suck in and destroy the German armour, which intending, as you remember when we started the podcast before on Epsom, this is all about clearing the way, sucking in reserves so that the Americans can make their major attack.
Much of that's an irrelevance.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, it is legitimate for there to be more than one objective in an offensive. And, of course, there were perfectly valid contingency plans for a breakthrough.
Yeah, so it's not wrong that Montgomery did plan for it. Of course he bloody planned for the possibility of a breakthrough. Now, the British have a lot to learn from Operation Epsom. I think that's the thing that I'd like to point out. And the first thing that they had to learn and remember and should have learned anyway is the strength and resilience of German defences. Do you think we'd appreciated how what it was?
No, I mean, typically, it had been badly underestimated. Now, it had also exposed serious problems in the coordination of the tanks with the infantry and artillery units, which was only masked by the overarching ability of the Royal Artillery to dominate the battlefield.
So without the Royal Artillery, the counterattacks on the flanks of the Scottish
corridor been successful,
which would have been terrible. So is this a German victory?
No, for them too, the Epsom fighting has mixed results. In one sense, they'd succeeded, throwing back the attempt to reach the River Orne.
So it's a minor tactic. They'd achieved that tactical objective.
Yeah, but they'd also abandoned their own overall plan of gathering together their panzer divisions ready for the decisive blow to hurl back the Allies into the English Channel.
Ooh, that is serious. That's a real tactical negative aspect to this.
Instead of that, the 2nd Panzer Corps had been frittered away, to no real purpose, as all their attacks had been blunted.
So what are we saying about Operation Epsom? No winners?
No, for both sides, it's a disappointment.
But I hope you're enjoying it. I mean, I find this tank fighting very, very, it's very tense. It's awful. And the next episode on Operation Goodwood is really, really terrible. And which is where we get the title Burning Steel from, which, I'll remind you again, Burning Steel, a tank regiment at war, 1939-45, published by Profile Books back on 12th of May. Your chance to buy. Should be pretty cheap by now. I hope you enjoy it. I can't get over how much we owe to those men who fought in the tanks. And whenever I write one of these books, it's not, as you've said, it's nothing really to do with me. I just link the quotes together. It's the quotes that's the book, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would expand that to include the debt we owe to all of the services and all the supporting services as well.
So it's not just tanks, it's not just the artillery, it's not just the infantry, it's everybody involved. Right, well, thanks for joining me, although I'm in your house, so thank you for having me.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?